Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us. Jim and Austin, we'd like to talk a little bit today about the recent article we published on Strategy Page, sort of a review of the wars over the last year. One of the interesting things I found about that article, Jim, was that you mentioned that violence is in decline.
Been in decline since the end of the Cold War, but the other trend that's been going on is since the period of decolonization after, well, in the 1960s mainly, there has been a decline in wars, but there's been an increase in what you could, I guess, more accurately call civil disorder. Most of the wars going on now are not wars in the conventional sense. They're basically just, you know, civil wars, if you can call them that. I mean, you know, often they're tribes and warlords. Not what we consider in the West to be a civil war, where you have, you know, two, maybe three or four, you know, major factions, you know, duking it out for the right to rule the country. But it's multiple factions. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, for example, what you have is an internal struggle among the Pushtun tribes, which straddle, you know, both the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's 40 million of them, and they've been trouble for centuries. You know, they're like the Kurds. There's never been a Pushtun stand because they can't agree among themselves. And anybody who wanders in, you know, it's like a cop going in to deal with a domestic disturbance. You know, the combatants turn on the cop. So left to their own devices, they're fighting each other. Anybody goes in there, stop the fight, they turn on the, you know, the peacemaker. And this is the case in a lot of countries. That's why we don't get involved in a lot of places. For example, Colombia. We send guns and money. And the Colombians eventually, you know, shut down most of the, you know, the rebellious factions down there. But it's the same in, you know, Ivory Coast, where you have another flare-up of civil disorder. Burma, Myanmar, as the dictators like to call the place now. You name it, you know, that's what's really causing the violence. So the big problem is there are no wars no more.
Now, Austin, there's a lot going on in the Africa still, though, correct?
Oh, yeah. Look, I know what Jim says. Let me pick up on something. There are wars going on, but what he's talking about, too, is, and when he says the civil disorder, it's that many of these places, and this is going to relate back to your question about Africa, many of these spots on the planet, the borders are, if they weren't drawn in European parlors, as the saying goes about the sub-Saharan African borders, they're drawn by convenience among the elites, and they don't reflect on-the-ground demography, and often don't reflect common-sense geographic borders either. And you have the trappings of a state, as I often said, about various emirates and in the Middle East, they're tribes with flags, and they nominally have in some cases, a president, a prime minister, or a king. But and then they have a seat in the UN now, but it doesn't make them quote unquote nation states. And that's certainly, now to get back to East Africa, that's one of the situations that you see cropping up. Really, I said East Africa, throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Let's take the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, for example. You've got Kinshasa, and then you've got all kinds of tribal relationships, and so in many cases economic relationships, given the amount of resources that Congo has got, but you don't have the ability to conduct police to put down violence. Local tribal militias sometimes arise not to be used as as weapons for our warlord, but simply to try to protect the villages. And that's certainly happened in northeastern Congo. And in Sudan, to get to Sudan, which is one of several real problems in East Africa. You'll talk about in the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, versus Djibouti, tribal problems that plague both Ethiopia and Kenya, and then you migrate to Sudan. And look, Sudan went through one of several long-term struggles between what we call the North and the South. Colonialism, the Brits created Sudan, run from Khartoum, but the Khartoum is primarily a Arabized, predominantly Muslim area. That's the North. And the South, what they call South Sudan or Southern Sudan, with its now capital at in the town of Juba, is predominantly Black African, Christian or animist in terms of religion, and easily 1,000 years they've been dealing with these the animist tribes. The Black animist tribes dealing with pressure from Arab Muslims. And you see that reflected on across a belt, really along the Sahel as well. It cuts Uganda, suffers from it, Nigeria on the west coast of Africa. That Muslim Christian or Arab Black African competition. So. And the ability for Khartoum to control police Sudan as a nation state, well, it can't do it. That's why it's also got an insurrection going on in Darfur, and we've discussed Darfur before. Is it a genocide? It's certainly the way the Khartoum government has run the operations. It's an ethnic cleansing, which that's genocide by another name. Yes, they've run that. They did the same thing. The Northern Government, National Congress Party, practiced many of these, used many of these same techniques against the South for 20 years, including slaving, or the so-called Muslim militias, many of them is Arabized tribes, would go down and capture Black Africans and bring them north. And many of them would essentially operate as slaves or indentured servants working for in businesses or households in northern Sudan. And in some cases, it was claimed that it wasn't slaving. It was just a kidnapping operation because they would have ransomed the individuals back as the southerners would pay a ransom if they could find them to get their relatives back. So you've got the... What's going on really on this coming Sunday, on January the 9th, is in 2005, we had a comprehensive peace agreement that ended the two-decades-long struggle between the North and South. And again, remember, that was an echo effect. That struggle had been going on in some shape, form, or fashion for centuries. And what... Aid organizations, diplomats, even the government of Southern Sudan, which is nominally semi-autonomous, operating out of Juba, says that Southerners are overwhelmingly going to opt for independence, which the North calls secession, by the way. There's some reason to believe that we're going to see a comparatively peaceful separation. Would occur later this year if the independence referendum is approved by the people of Southern Sudan, and then you'll have a new Southern Sudan state, complete with its own government, its own flag, but also the same kind of problems that plague the rest of Sudan because of tribes Nuba Land, Dinka tribes, and the like that have historical tribal conflicts. And you're going to have a poor country that does get oil revenues. I didn't talk about oil in this case, but because you're really talking, we're really talking about the ability to exercise a police and security function. But the southern Sudan's going to have to face some of the same problems that Sudan did as well. And this is what, to bring back to what Jim was saying, this is civil disorder. Well, civil may have advanced it too many centuries because you're dealing with tribal disorder. But then the Pashtuns are a complex tribal group, and many of the things, as Jim described a few moments ago, is that you're dealing with, they're at odds with one another on a tribal or clan basis until the outside force intervenes, and then they all turn on the outside force. Is that what's going to happen in Sudan? No, I don't think so. I don't see an outside force moving in, and the peacekeeping forces that have been both in Darfur and in southern Sudan, because there's a UN mission in Sudan, a peacekeeping force that's been there since 2005, at best mediocre, largely ineffective. But they, in at least in the southern sector, the tribes haven't turned on the peacekeepers yet.
Right.
So I'm using Sudan as an example of what Jim means by civil disorder. Some of it is ancient tribal rivalries and tribal wars that are now portrayed in the context of nation states that are either failed states or never were states.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you talk about, Jim, and I guess we could call it the media effect, it's something I've been watching since I was a undergraduate student reading David Singer and his theses on how violence was declining at that time in the early 80s. And I was always interested in it because when I was around people that believed in the wars and rumors of war's prophecy, that it was a sign of the end of times, they would come up to me and tell me how awful things were getting, and I would correct them. Some of my religion professors got upset at me when I do this, but that I think the effect of people thinking that there's more violence is what you've pointed out, is how the media tends to cover things.
Yeah, you know, the media learned back in the 19th century when mass market newspapers first became possible because of the steam press. I mean, that's one of the great, scientific innovations in history, and it gets little press, so to speak. But it made the mass media possible, and the mass media quickly found out that good news doesn't sell. Bad news sells. And if you haven't got any bad news, you can always invent some. One of the most egregious, methods for doing that was on a slow news day. This I think first started happening back in the 1890s. It became infamous, as it were, at least in New York City. They'd invent a crime wave, and the way they invent a crime wave was simply report more crimes that were actually occurring. Now, as you found out, when you actually go out and do the statistics, as it were, there may actually be less crime than, say, the previous month or the previous year. But if you simply report more murders and more, assaults and what have you, you give the impression that there's a crime wave. And you say, without lying, although lying was certainly employed, when all else failed, that why isn't something done about this? Why is crime out of control? People are becoming more aware, more what I call media literate in the last few decades. Now, this is unusual because when I was a kid, this is in the 1950s, people read this stuff and they'd scratch their heads. Although I must say, back then, in the 50s and 60s, the journalists tended to be more honest. A kid I played in a rock and roll band with, his father was the editor of one of the local newspapers, and I'd talk to him, I'd go over to visit, and there'd be Dad, putting it was a weekly paper. It's a small town upstate New York. And I was aware of current events, and I'd talk about it. And he was always making a point, you gotta get two sources, you gotta do the truth, you lie, people know you're a liar, they won't buy your paper anymore, et cetera, et cetera. This has dissolved, but it turns out that this idea of honest reporting was, an American bad habit, as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Newspapers began in the 18th century as basically partisan, propaganda bought and paid for by somebody who could afford it. That's back when newspapers were very expensive. And they'd be pasted up, they'd be nailed to the some public square so more people, could read it because they couldn't afford to buy it. And this tradition continues in Europe to this day. But in the United States, in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was a great period of reform, and there arose the idea of honest journalism. It was considered revolutionary. Didn't catch on anywhere else, and it didn't last in the United States, by and large, although we still pay lip service to it, but, we all know what goes on in the mainstream media these days. You try and be, honest, and they accuse you of, not agreeing with them and therefore suspect. This whole idea of getting an accurate, idea of what is actually going on in the world as far as wars goes doesn't work if you just read the media. I mean, we use some of the mainstream media for stories. I get most of my information from work, so to speak. We have systems that basically take in the news, as it were, and sort it out. So I can get, summaries, as it were, and get trends. That's what we're basically looking for, on Wall Street. But when I go look at the raw news feeds, it's all partisan, trying to make a point, twisting statistics and what have you. But Dan, as you discovered, when you give people who basically only feed off the mainstream media, the true numbers, they look at you kind of funny. Argue with you, maybe even try and hit you, because you're upsetting their perception of reality. But reality isn't what you read in the newspapers. Hasn't
right.
been for some time.
Now, one of the things that's probably underreported, except for occasionally in our press, is what's going on down in Mexico.
I actually think there's pretty good coverage of that from some media sources. There are.
Well, I think you're right on some media sources, but yeah. I mean,
I'll name two. The El Paso Times is quite good at it, and there's a newspaper. The San Antonio Express News is pretty good at it. I mean, we even have mentioned the Express News on the website as a source for good information, and along with the Miami Herald on Central America, as well as Mexico. And I'll even add a third. San Diego Union Tribune, but what do all three of those particular papers that I've mentioned have in common? Two of them are right in the border, and then the other one is, South Texas and on into eastern Mexico, San Antonio paper. So I do think they're getting coverage.
And but not national
coverage. There's a couple of other small Texas border papers, one in Brownsville. As an example, that they're committed, that are doing what to them is local coverage, and the locals know what's gone on, and they're reflecting those particular media outlets are reflecting what everybody is aware of.
But that's not bubbling. Austin, that's not bubbling up to the national level. So somebody living up in Bay.
It may not be. I'm not going to debate that. But I do encounter this a lot, saying, "Oh, nobody's covering it." And my comeback to it is, well, "Wait a minute." And I usually just name a couple, but I've gone through a half dozen, and all of these media outlets have websites. It's some degree you have to sit in and filter it. But the El Paso Times, for example, it can't help but cover Juarez. Because Juarez is just an El Paso, or right next to each other, and Juarez is larger than El Paso. Now, I won't, the question is that filtering through the rest traditional mainstream media. Tough call. I do see some of it. What tends to happen is, though, and this is something that Jim and I have talked about really since the first edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, when we were working on it in late 83 and early 1984, which is the so-called sudden media focus. That'd be called parachute journalism. Sometimes it's called a media orgasm, where suddenly there's a story that's just discovered, and it's like big, huge instant news, but if you step back and the in our case, following a conflict, you have an expert come in, like Jim Dunnigan, and say, excuse me, this really been going on about 35 years, and this is where it started, and you just now discovered it. Alright, so that tends to be what you're, I think, are complaining about, Dan, is that tends to be the way major national media covers it. They also tend to cover it from an angle of who's at fault, good guy or bad guy. One slant, it's always U.S. policy, the United States at fault. Another one that's another meme that has showed up in Mexico is Mexico's a failed state. Part of that comes from what I believe to be a misreading, a Joint Forces Command document that came out for what I guess in 2009, talking about the effects of Pakistan as a failed state and what might happen if Mexico were. But Mexico's nowhere near a failed state. Yet that was picked up by a sufficient number of, as Jim is alluding to, sensationalists. And that's a way that they see Mexico, not a concern that somewhere down the line Mexico's governmental institutions could fail in toto, become a failed state. But there's always a possibility, but no, that's what we're dealing with, or it's on the precipice of it. And that's not the case. That's not the case if you take a look at actually what's been going on steadily in Mexico since at least the 1980s. Or that, as we point out on the strategy page this week, I believe we've got something up that even talked about the 1997 national elections and how the National Action Party and Party of the Democratic Revolution, which is a left-wing party, the Pan National Action Party is a kind of a center-right party, worked out a tactical coalition to take over the Chamber of Deputies, the lower house in Mexico, and they took it over from the Institutional Revolutionary Party that basically ruled completely and in toto and with a great deal of corruption in Mexico for almost 70 years. You've seen change, opening up of institutions, concern about corruption. I mean, you've got, the other thing is that Mexican media, you know, over the last 10, 12 years, and I'm not just saying this because I'm following it, I've also noted this by some of the papers that I mentioned a few moments ago. They're in touch with journalists in Mexico. Mexican media has become a lot more active. Some of it may have to do with the internet as well, particularly in polling that shows that the Mexican people they don't trust their own judiciary and they don't trust their own police. Okay, well, we knew this, but now they're expressing it. One of the institutions they do trust is the Mexican military, particularly Mexican Army. Oh, that's interesting. Interestingly enough, President Felipe Calderon is relying on the Mexican military as his instrument for waging what we call on strategy page the cartel war. But here's another example, another point that gets lost, because this one doesn't have, you know, bloodletting and guns and a lot of bang to it. But Calderon is actually taking an institutional reform approach, reforming the judiciary, reforming the police, economic reform, because he says Mexico must modernize. And part of that modernization process is ending the leg of, you know, first of all, dealing with current corruption and ending the way ultimately that the corruption has had malign effects on Mexico socially and economically. That's a huge, huge project. It's a 3 or 4 decade project. But Calderon, and you can go back again looking through some of what's been going on in Mexico over the last 15 years, Calderon is addressing it. Not a failed state. Now, does that bubble up in the mainstream media, Dan? Do you see that?
Well, I think what you see is, again, the sensationalism where
what I just outlined is as big a story, and it really may be the larger historical point, that in no way makes up for the hideous number of people murdered, even though this is another element that escapes a great deal of the attention. They looked at what was over 3,000 people were murdered in Ciudad Juarez in 2010. A lot of them murdered in gangs, killing each other and catching people in the crossfire as they fight over a smuggling corridor. All right, there's a drug smuggling corridor. And where's that drug smuggling corridor going? To the United States. The United States drug appetite is definitely involved in that. So it's not just a Mexican problem. There's a U.S. social problem that's not the sole cause by any stretch. But that's something that exacerbates what goes on in Mexico. It's extremely complicated. I do see things occasionally in the mainstream media talking about the U.S. drug problem. But that's... And talking about what do we do with it, do we legalize it? Okay, well, we discussed that what narcotics are going to legalize. Is that going to resolve everything that's going on with the cartel war in Mexico? No, it's not, because as Calderon points out, we're dealing with a number of long-term social and economic issues that we shoved aside, or they were neglected, or just that was the go-along, get-along during the long time that the Institutional Revolutionary Party was in charge. So,
well, you know, speaking of history and the drugs, a lot of people just tend to ignore the long history with these kinds of drugs, although, you know, the opiates only were invented, you know, in the 19th century. But, you know, drugs like opium, which are pretty potent, and hashish, they've been around for a long time. The only thing that's kept them from being a problem is they're expensive to make. They're basically made by hand. And labor, even, you know, when you had slaves, was expensive. And one of the first instances of widespread prohibition of drugs was opium in the 18th century, when they started manufacturing it in the Golden Triangle, where heroin later became which is derived from opium, later became a big, worldwide menace. And they made this relatively expensive opium, and they shipped it into China because China was going through an economic boom. And there was a large, maybe 10, 15% of the population had, you know, surplus money, you know, money to spend. And especially the young people spend it on opium, because that hasn't, I mean, things don't change that much over even centuries. And the young folks, especially the young men, they said, hey, this is cool, let's get high. And instead of rice wine or cannabis, which gave you a rather mild high, they went into the opium, which knocked you right out. The Chinese government suppressed opium, not for the first time, because it was basically ruining a generation. We had the same problem when the opiates came along in the 19th century. You know, the first was morphine, and that, you know, killed pain. It was a big deal for medical treatment. But then they found out, whoops. You know, this came about during the Civil War, and they found out, hey, this stuff is addictive. And it took decades, you know, for that to be realized. And it wasn't until about a century ago, a little over a century ago, that all that stuff was outlawed. Marijuana, as people point out now, was thrown in there. It shouldn't have been, because that's been around for thousands of years and is about as, you know, bad as alcohol. Which, of course, if you're riding a horse or a car, you know, it can still be fatal. You know, do not ride a horse under the influence of either. Believe me, it doesn't work. But the hard drugs are indeed a menace. And 110 years ago, you can go read, you'll probably find some of these old newspapers on the web. I mean, I read originals, you know, back in the 60s. And I said, what's all this crap about opium and you know, morphine? And because you could buy heroin on the Montgomery Ward's catalog. Is that still around? Anyway, mail order catalogs, they advertised it. And it was mainly advertised for whatever reason, I never got into the details of that, as a PMS, a female troubles, as they call them, a PMS cure. But a lot of guys bought them ostensibly for their wives, and they went and used it themselves. But it was basically a wrecking, you know, families. It was a big problem by making it, you know, freely available. Now, in some European countries, they make it freely available, but they backed away from that. So you can see what's happening. You have a problem. You know what the cause and effect is going to be, or at least there's a record of it, and you ignore it. And this is where the media really falls down. Somebody should be watching the history books, which of course you can do much more easily, you know, with the internet now. And so when a so-called new problem pops up, say, well, wait a minute, hasn't something like this, or even in this case, we're talking identical. The Chinese were, you know, banning opium, you know, 200 and 300 years ago, and it's still being banned for the same damn reason. So, I mean, nothing has changed. The one thing that has changed is there's more wealth running around. This is why the United States, North America, and Europe is such a heroin and cocaine magnet, because that's where the money is. Just like with robbing banks. Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. You don't go to a candy store. And the more money you have, you know, the more demand you're going to have for these drugs, because, you know, people can afford it, and this stuff will, you know, enhance your life, so to speak. But it enhances your life to the point where you can't do anything else, and most people don't approve of that.
Well,
in the process, because of the way that it is currently marketed, and I'm using market in the broadest sense, Dan, you have gangs operating in South America, Central America, and then North America as well, because Mexico and the United States and even into Canada, who are providing the wholesale and retail end of it. It's a huge amount of money, and it certainly exacerbated the already extant corruption problems in Mexico.
Right.
And look, this gets...
But again, look at history.
At some level, both in the U.S. and Mexican media.
But again, pay attention to history. You have these problems of, gangster or criminal organizations, large cartels, as they like to call themselves, getting very wealthy over an illicit substance. They have been suppressed. You know, heroin used to be mainly grown in the Golden Triangle. It no longer is. Why is that? It wasn't by magic. It was by several governments getting together, just as the Chinese did 300 years ago. Maybe somebody remembered, hey, didn't we have this problem here before? Go check the records. What did we do? Oh, okay, let's do it again. Same way the Pakistanis got the heroin business out of their tribal territories. And, of course, some people are saying, at least so I'm hearing from Washington, if we drive it out of Afghanistan, where's it going to land? You know, it's a plague that you can never stop out. It's like bed bugs. You can't destroy them completely. There are always a few of them left. And they're going to go someplace else, so let's plan ahead. Same thing that's happening in Colombia. You know, cocaine production has been dropping the last 3 years in Colombia, but it's not been dropping absolutely. It's been moving to Ecuador and Peru. And so you have a new problem there. So at least you've solved the Colombian problem. But I think people have to think not just smarter, but they have to think, you know, in a more informed way of basically looking at solutions that worked in the past, because a lot of them will still work today.
And going back to our tribal theme, when we look at these gang-related efforts in South America and Central America and other places also, is that, gangs, in essence, are their own tribe.
Yes, but gangs are also a cultural thing. I mean, this is very interesting. In Guatemala, in Central America, they didn't have gangs until quite recently. And the reason they got gangs was when we started, this is the law of unintended consequences, which is an iron law, just like Murphy's Law, they sort of work together. When we started expelling immigrants who were illegal immigrants who were, how does the law go? If you're a legal immigrant and you've been convicted of a felony, you get kicked out. And that's been on the books for a long time, but in the last few years, they started enforcing it. And that meant a lot of guys who were gangbangers, even if they weren't gangbangers anymore, or were gangbangers and had never been convicted of court and convicted of anything, once they got one felony, bang, they went back home. And a lot of them landed in Guatemala. And what did they bring with them, aside from, bad Spanish or a bad accent? The gangbanger mentality. Now, a lot of the kids down there had heard about it, but here they had real life examples. And here was a real life example of how the culture was changed by this infusion of, you know, people similar to us, but who had new customs. You know, we talk about how the West goes in and brings in Mickey Mouse and TV and all sorts of other crap. Well, the gang banging, you know, tradition is one of those things you wish didn't spread, but it did. And all of a sudden you have these gangs which are basically outdoing, you know, some of the worst gangs in the United States. And it was all just a cultural meme that got transported by a well-intentioned government program of expelling, you know, felons from the United, you know, immigrant felons from the United States, you know, back to their home countries.
Right.
So I have a question for you. And don't you think that there is an entertainment media role in some of this? Well, because I've certainly seen this when I've traveled Africa and Asia. They're watching not just U.S., but well, focus on Hollywood at first, but media glorification of gangs and gangsters, the kind of hip-hop gangs that we've certainly seen over that. When I'm using that in a broad sense, but going back to the 1980s, and it's in some ways a repeat of, you know, Hollywood focusing on Al Capone with, you know, Bogart and Cagney and the like. There was a kind of a romanticism of the gangster there.
But again, you got to remember, again, this is what goes around, comes around. If you go back to the Grimm's Brothers fairy tales, the original fairy tales, they could only be shown on cable if you were to use them to make the right scripts, because they were, horrible stuff was going on. They basically bolderized them. But the original versions that were preserved, and the idea of, you know, throwing the kids into the oven and stuff like that. Well, that was the mild stuff they left in. There was a lot worse stuff, you know, which was in the originals. So this idea of the Roman games, you say, oh, weren't those ancients terrible? Well, have you ever gone to an English soccer game and not watched the field but watched what's going on in the standing room area? Things haven't changed, and as much as people try and control the decorum level, as it were, of mass media, you're going to get, you know, this lowering of the tone, as it were, to the as they like to call it, the common denominator, where everybody wants basically dog fights and bear baiting and what have you. While you can't have real blood sports, there's no law against simulated blood sports. And these are very popular. And the more artfully you do them, the more popular they are. That's why Rambo and you know, American action adventure, you know, movies are so popular, because they are honed by craftsmen, by artists, really. People who have, you know, complete command, you know, how to manipulate, you know, emotions, you know, with actions, movie and whatever, all the components that go into making an exciting movie. And we are all excited by these things. I mean, a well put together action movie, you know, is basically visually, orally, whatever, you know, it catches your attention. And yeah, sure, it does. But they've also shown that, these things do not have as close a correlation to increasing violence in society as you might think, because when they studied, it was video games, violent video games, when they studied them across various cultures, they found out there was not as strong, there was some, which of course was extrapolated by the media showing, oh, direct, you know, heavy, but no, there was very little. They could find no, in some many countries like Japan, they could find no correlation between, you know, playing violent video games and increases in youth violence. So it's still kind of murky, but it's been there for thousands of years. What were they telling around the campfires, you know, 3,000 years ago?
Right.
Violent hunting or warfare stories. And then I ripped his lungs out. Hey!
Well, I would recommend anybody that hasn't read our review of the wars to go there and look at the stuff that we haven't had time to touch on. Also, just sort of closing things up, you know, even though we'd like to give peace a chance, there are a lot of people out there that don't want to give it a chance and will be there for years and years to come.
You can depend on it.
Yep. All right. We'll talk to you next time, gentlemen. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.